Good evening and welcome to this final lecture in the fall series of the Vancouver Institute. I'm Ann Ironside and I want to welcome you and to thank you once again for your attendance at this series and tell you how much we appreciate your participation and by coming, by buying memberships, by your donations. And also to tell you that the spring series will begin on January the 22nd, and it will begin with the new president of Simon Fraser University, John Stubbs. And if you sign up outside tonight, then we will send you the brochure in mid-January. Before I introduce you to Professor Kiefer, I want to acknowledge the part that Dr. Peter Nemetz plays in putting all of these Vancouver Institute programs together with the program committee and the of which he is chair and the executive. Peter? Thank you. Peter carries this on in the great tradition set by his mother, who was Belle Nemetz. So tonight's speaker is Professor Susan Kiefer, who is the new head of the Department of Geological Sciences in the Faculty of Science here at UBC. She came 3 months ago, and she will be speaking tonight on researching the Earth, living it, loving it, and sharing it. She's originally from Pennsylvania. She received her PhD from the California Institute of Technology, where she studied planetary sciences and physics and math. She is the winner of the Day Medal from the Geological Society of America for her work in the application of physics and chemistry to the solving of geological problems. She's also the winner of the Spendyarov Prize from the Soviet Academy of Sciences. And this prize is awarded every 4 years to the most outstanding geologist in the country that hosts the International Geological Congress. She is a geological fluid dynamicist, and what that means is that she studies large geological events such as river floods and geyser eruptions, volcanic eruptions, meteorite impacts. And tonight in her presentation, she's going to be talking at the processes that connect all of these events. Please welcome Professor Kiefer.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, for the introduction, and good evening to all of you who've come out on this rainy night to this lecture. I'm going to jump right in to my talk, and I'd really like you to get comfortable and pretend that maybe you're sitting around a nice, warm campfire, which is my first slide. Which might be my first slide. Could we have the first slide?
I think you have to turn this.
No, it was this one. I told her I had a one-sentence introduction. And it was a short sentence. Okay, we have the red phone here. Hi, Mickey, could we have the first slide? Hi, Mickey. I pressed that button. There we go. Okay. There we go. Wait, we want the campfire. We have to set the atmosphere here. I told Anne that I'd actually dealt with most catastrophes. Don't hit that button. Right, I got it. I fell off a stage once giving a 10-minute talk, and I was really reassured to find that I was on the low side of this platform. I'd like you to pretend that you're in a geologic field camp and that we're just going to tell some stories tonight. And with these stories, I'm going to try to convey to you my ideas about the ingredients that I think are needed in society, and particularly in an educational institution, to nurture the growth and productivity of students and researchers. And there will also be some science in these stories, but I have to warn you that if you came to hear about rocks, you're going to have a disappointing evening, because I'm hardly going to talk about rocks at all. Now, is there anybody in the top who can't hear me, or that would like to sneak out before they find out I'm not talking about rocks? Okay, I'll assume you can hear me. Okay, I think I've mastered this. I'm going to show you some examples of supersonic flow in geology and leave you with the impression, I hope, that in our studies of the Earth, we need and take all of the help that we can get from the other sciences, chemistry, physics, fluid dynamics, and even aeronautical engineering. I'm not going to develop any of the thermodynamic or fluid dynamic arguments in detail, but I need to tell you sort of one fact to build the base for my talk. My students at ASU call these factlets or factoids. This Grumman F-14 Navy fighter jet is traveling faster than the speed of sound in air, and so it's in a condition that we call supersonic. The Mach number of this airplane is the ratio of its velocity to the velocity of sound in air, and it's much greater than 1 for this type of aircraft. And the shock waves that occur in this state are outlined by the condensed moisture behind the jet. And as it passes overhead, for example, you would hear a sonic boom due to these shock waves. Most processes in geology or in our everyday lives are well below supersonic velocities. We live, walk, drive, and fly on commercial aircraft at very low Mach numbers. Our intuition is conditioned in this world, and we have very little intuition for supersonic phenomena. The world that I live in professionally, however, is a world of boiling water, as in geysers, or very nasty, dusty gases in volcanic eruptions. And these fluids can have very, very low sound speeds. For example, boiling water can have a sound speed as low as 1 meter a second, and that's roughly the velocity that I could walk across this platform. It could have a velocity as low as 10 meters a second, which is the velocity that a very fast sprinter could go across here. So if Mother Nature provides conditions that propel fluids to velocities faster than this, then those fluids travel supersonically, because they're flowing faster than their own sound speeds. And they have to be analyzed with tools and equations that are appropriate to this weird world. And that's the basic fact that underlies a lot of what I'm going to talk about. And it's really the only technically difficult concept that I'm going to evoke tonight. Rather, in developing the ideas and facts of supersonic flow for you, I'm going to talk about research as a way of life and about the intertwined roles of research and teaching in education, because these are topics of concern to me. And I wanted to start by defining research very broadly as the constructive implementation of human curiosity. And to justify taking a very personal approach to the topic of research, and including experiences from my own life leading up to my work of the past 15 years on supersonic flow, I quote a recent publication by the U.S. National Academy of Sciences called On Being a Scientist. The conclusion reads as follows. Many people harbor misconceptions about the nature and aims of science. They believe it to be a cold, impersonal search for a truth devoid of human values. Scientists know that these misconceptions are mistaken, but the misconceptions can be damaging. They can influence the way scientists are treated by others, they can discourage young people from pursuing interests in science, and at worst, they distort science-based decisions that must be made in a technological society. Scientists must work to counter these feelings. They should not disguise the human factors that motivate and sustain research, or the value judgments that inevitably influence science. They should explain and defend the scientific worldview, a prospect of great beauty and grandeur that ought to be a part of how people think about themselves and their place in nature. Scientific research is an intensely human endeavor. This humanity must not be lost in the face that science presents the world. That's the end of the quote. Research is a highly individualized way of life, and we who are researchers typically cherish our freedom to follow our nose into the mysteries and challenges. In a 1967 book called The Art of the Soluble, Peter Medawar said, "Scientists are people of very dissimilar temperaments, doing very different things in different ways. Among scientists are collectors, classifiers, and compulsive tidiers up. Many are detectives by temperament, and many are explorers. Some are artists, and some are artisans. There are poet scientists and philosopher scientists, and even a few mystics." In spite of these individualities, I would like to suggest that there are at least five elements of creativity and research that can be defined and must be nurtured by families, societies, and the institutions in which creative scientists work. The details of each of these five elements, which are motivation, education, opportunity, application, and support, are very different in the lives of individual researchers. Success or failure in research depends on the way that these elements intertwine. Different institutions might choose to place different relative emphasis on these five elements. For example, elementary schools typically deal with motivation, education, and early opportunity, whereas research institutes might deal primarily with opportunity, support, and application. Institutions such as universities that are charged with guarding and fostering human knowledge must optimize all five elements so that the individuals working and studying there have the best chance to contribute positively to the world. The word research tends to be associated with the activities of mature individuals in established institutions. But I took some artistic license in addressing this problem by using a set of photos of a curious child who spent a very, very long time trying to figure out how to move this rock as the background for these slides, because I think that research is a process begun early in life and nurtured and fostered by education, opportunity, support, and application. Universities play a major role in the transformation of childish curiosity and stubbornness into childlike research, dedication, and discipline. Researchers don't just appear out of the ranks of job applicants for vacant positions in government, industry, or university faculty. They start life as children and become motivated, educated, and given opportunities and choices throughout life. This is one of the themes that I hope to build on this evening as I lead you toward the factoids of supersonic flow and geology. So let me turn to the first element that I see as essential in fostering research. That's motivation. Motivation appears as sparks of curiosity at various times in life, and these sparks need to be nurtured. I confess that I don't know when I became motivated to become a researcher, but it was certainly well before I ever heard the word research, and probably even before I heard the word curiosity. The earliest incident that I can actually remember got me into quite a bit of trouble. I grew up in rural western Pennsylvania and walked to and from school each day wearing frocks and socks, as did little girls in the 1940s. Each trip took me past an incredible ditch. It was really a good, slimy, stinky Pennsylvania ditch. And after many days of trying to figure out what was in the bottom of this ditch, I got very frustrated because the bottom was well beyond the reach of my arms or any available stick. My curiosity finally got the better of my judgment, and I decided that the only way I was going to figure out what was in the bottom of this ditch was to jump in. Well, it never occurred to me that I probably should not be wearing my best dress and my brand new shoes when I did this. And needless to say, what I found in the bottom of that ditch was very benign compared to what I found out when I got home that night to my parents. I think it's a pretty good assumption to say that... Did I miss one? Yeah, oops. Oh, we've got skipping slides here. I think it's really a pretty good assumption that we'd all agree on to say that curiosity and motivation are present in our children. So let's go on to the theme of education. Jumping into the ditch did not result in an early start in either research or geology for me. But I was in a home environment that required mastery of basic skills, demanded good study habits, and nurtured talents, dreams, and resolutions in the school system through courses in art, music, languages, and lots of extracurricular activities. And I suspect that we who become researchers by profession have had our childhood motivation stimulated and yet disciplined by our home environments and by our early education. And yet I suspect we researchers in general need an incentive at an early age to decide that the demanding process of acquiring an education is going to be valuable to us. My resolution to get an education through to the PhD level was the result of probably what's a typical adolescent vow. That was that no one or institution was going to be able to control me. And in my junior year in high school, girls had to take home economics and boys had to take shop, period. That was not arguable. And I really didn't want to take home ec. I had absolutely no talent for sewing, and I despised the pink linen that I was assigned to make a dress out of. I really wanted to be down in the shop where the boys seemed to be having much more fun. And the more I tried to get out of home ec and into shop, the more the school system seemed determined that I was going to take home ec. And this is when I formed the resolution to make sure that no one could control my life. And I looked around me and I saw that the people who had the freedom were those nasty teachers. And they had the control, and they had it because they had the education. So I made my personal declaration that I was going to get an education and get out from under the thumb of those teachers. Well, I had this declaration of independence firmly in place when Sputnik was launched in 1957. And that was the year that I had my first general science course. John F. Kennedy was the president of the United States, and he had a real or a political dream that we'd send a man to the moon and return him safely. I decided I was his man. And being a very innocent and very naive 15-year-old, I really couldn't see any difference between men and women, and therefore it didn't faze me that the only schools in the U.S. that would lead directly to being an astronaut wouldn't take women students. I learned every rule and regulation of West Point, Annapolis, and the Coast Guard Academy, but I discovered that their rules were nearly as rigid as the home ec requirement in junior high school. However, I knew that I had a lot of learning to do and before I'd get to the moon, and I believed that there would be a way around rules and regulations that didn't seem to make any sense. So I made plans to go to college, and I ended up going to Allegheny College, which was a small liberal arts college at the huge distance of 60 miles from my home. And I thought it would be fun to be a chem major because I'd had a really great and explosive chemistry course in high school. I had to work to help with my college expenses, and I was lucky enough to get a job the summer after high school in what I thought was science. And in hindsight, I think that my vision of science was that of being a medical doctor, because this was all that was available in the small rural town I grew up in. I became an assistant to the pathologist at the local hospital. This meant that I spent the whole summer scrubbing down the morgue after autopsies, helping examine a very large number of tonsils under the microscope, and occasionally even had to carry an arm or a leg to and from the operating room to the deep freeze. I never told my parents about this job, and I actually think they confused it with my duties as a candy striper, in which role I took milkshakes and smiles to the hospital patients. Well, my job the next summer, after my freshman year as a chem major, was in a real major research program with a chemistry professor. The job was to analyze mouse blood in a cancer research program, and this is our little lab group in college at the time. And by this time, organic chemistry, which I couldn't begin to understand, was my next requirement as a chem major. I had had quite a bit of blood and organics in my career by this time, and I decided it didn't have anything to do with getting to the moon as being an astronaut. And so I switched majors to physics and math. My college did not have a geology option at the time, or if it did, it wasn't called to my attention as a female. These were the years when women were not allowed into the mines or onto drill rigs or even onto educational field trips. But during these undergraduate years, I was getting the foundations essential for scientific research: excellent and committed teachers, individualized guidance, and importantly, a science faculty all involved in research in some way. I was one of three physics majors per year in a college that had three physics professors as faculty members, and so we effectively each had our own profs. My especially inspirational professor was a woman who had escaped from Hungary during the Budapest invasion, only spoke Hungarian, studied quantum mechanics to escape a refugee camp, Came to America to start her life, worked a year as a librarian to learn English, and then started teaching the three of us quantum mechanics. I don't think that these professors cared whether I was a chemistry, math, physics, or biology major. They cared about teaching us to think. And the learning was fun. I still remember the mental thrill of, oh yeah, when a math professor showed us that the first time derivative of distance was velocity. I remember the feeling of awe when the chemistry professor revealed the beauty of nature displayed in the periodic chart of the elements. I actually stayed up all night constructing a periodic chart of the elements in which I could put pennies into the orbitals for electrons. And I remember the amazement at being shown the systematic arrangement of atoms in the structures of compounds of minerals. I and two other physics majors in my class stayed up all night constructing our vision of the atomic structure of a mineral out of marshmallows and toothpicks so that it could be prominently placed on our professor's desk when she arrived at work the next morning. For me, this was no mean feat because in those days, the female students were locked in the dorm at 10 o'clock at night. This was the philosophy of how you controlled the boys. You let the boys run around all night and you locked up the girls. And the punishment for staying out after hours was fairly severe, even if you were in physics lab. Well, I like to use this rather droopy mineral structure, which is, I guess, 30 years old now, to symbolize a castle and quote Thoreau. If you have built castles in the air, your work need not be lost. That is where they should be. Now put the foundations under them. We as educators need somehow to give our children, and by this I mean not just our real children, but generically the children who are entrusted to us as university professors, the motivation and aspirations to build castles in the air. And then we need to provide the educational system in the public schools, the colleges, and the universities for the foundations. At the college time in their lives, students are learning what research is by association with researchers, but it is typically a long time before they have all of the tools in place to become a researcher themselves. Students and even young faculty committed to research and education need to know that there are no shortcuts in the lifelong arduous process of learning. It's a vocation that requires dedication, persistence, harsh honesty with oneself and peers, and always the acknowledgement that as right as we may prove ourselves to be, science is only one of the many ways to look at the world. Well, to get back to the personal level on this topic, as soon as I terminated my non-budding career in biology, I wanted to find a summer job that would lead more directly to the moon. I blanketed every NASA installation in the U.S. with job applications, and I landed a job as a student intern at Goddard Space Flight Center. The first day I walked in, I met my boss here and found out that he was a very intimidating West Point graduate. And he introduced himself by saying, "My research is determine the shape of the Earth by using tensor harmonics and programming them on a computer." Well, I came from a college where we were still using log tables, and the big homework assignment was to interpolate logs and anti-logs. And so I had to say to him, "Sir, what's a tensor harmonic and what's a computer?" Each time that he and I have gotten together over the last 25, and it's actually now 30 years, we recollect the influence that we had on each other's careers. It turns out that in my awe and terror of him, I never realized what a terror he thought I was. We needed each other. I needed him for the inspiration and example of what a research life could be. And he needed me and the other young people in NASA, in the NASA internship program, for intellectual stimulation, challenge, and just plain fun. Close work with an experienced scientist still remains one of the most important aspects of a scientific education for students. Conversely, as Frank Press, the president of the National Academy of Sciences, has said, any experienced researcher who does not pass on to younger scientists a sense of the norms and methods of science is significantly diminishing his or her contribution to the field's progress. Well, the opportunities that I had to interact with experienced researchers escalated when I went from my roots in rural Pennsylvania to Caltech. By the time I finished my PhD thesis, I had spent a year studying solar physics. I had had two or three false starts on theses that didn't pan out. I had delved into some pretty heavy-duty physical chemistry and statistical mechanics to explain thermodynamic properties of minerals. And I'd finally focused on the damaging effects left by the Canyon Diablo meteorite when it hit the rocks at what was to become known as Meteor Crater. I left my undergraduate college as a starry-eyed physics and math major wanting to study the planets, and I left Caltech as a pedigreed planetary scientist more realistically wanting to study the Earth. The manned space program had more or less come and gone without me. I'd gotten married and had a child along the way. And yet, as I've explained to my son, my dream of becoming an astronaut seemed intact because along the way, opportunities and interests had changed, and interactions with good professors had guided me from childish dreams into realistic visions. These days, universities are under a lot of scrutiny regarding the relative roles of teaching, mentoring, and research. Not only is there public scrutiny about faculty responsibilities, but there's frequently internal tension amongst faculty members who have different emphases. A lot of the data that I learned in these undergraduate and graduate school classrooms and the techniques that I had mastered in the labs were already outdated by the time I graduated, and they were irrelevant to my life because of changes in the world and my own life. In the debates about teaching and research in universities, it's frequently overlooked that the goal of a university is neither teaching nor research. It's education, and it's preparing students for the lifelong job of living in and responding to a complex and rapidly changing world. Taken individually, classroom teaching, mentoring, and individual guidance in research are parts of a much larger scale process of education. If done well, a student leaves the university ready to take an independent role in the world, and it's most likely that that role is going to be very different than the role they had in mind when they entered. My 1950s dream of being an astronaut did not restrict me to being in a spaceship. The opportunities that I had during my years of graduate education to work with researchers who were trying to define cancer in mice and humans, who had hoped to solve the classic puzzle of the shape of the Earth, who were using the very first post-Sputnik satellites to explore the nature of the upper atmosphere, who were training astronauts, who were designing and exploring the planets with unmanned spacecraft, and who were tromping the deserts of the Southwest gave me a love of the Earth and the planets that took on quite a different version and vision from the childhood dreams of wanting to be an astronaut. I unabashedly love being a geologist, and one of the most rewarding aspects of giving this talk for me has been when kids come up to me and say, gee, I think I could think about being a geologist because it sounds like a lot of fun. Well, the third element that I believe is essential for a successful career in research is opportunity. And let me try to illustrate the effects of opportunity by telling you the bizarre turns that have happened in the 2 decades that I've been trying to study volcanoes. And this is the thread of my talk that actually leads into science and research as a body of facts. Remember that I said that the one scientific concept that I'd like you to take home from this lecture tonight is that supersonic flow, like in rockets, also occurs in geology. Anyone who works with planetary problems gets involved in meteorite impacts, and anyone who works with meteorite impacts has to learn about shock waves. As the meteorite that formed Meteor Crater in Arizona plummeted to the Earth about 40,000 years ago, it came in at such high velocity that the impact sent shockwaves around and around the Earth, both in the atmosphere and in the ground. These waves caused enormous pressures, and my own studies in supersonic flow began during my PhD thesis when I was trying to unravel the story of how the high pressures behind these shockwaves affected the rocks at Meteor Crater. Simultaneously, a fellow grad student named Tom McGetchen was studying kimberlites and diatremes and their relation to volcanic processes. We were good friends, and we were lucky enough to have the same thesis advisor, Gene Shoemaker, who had some of the earliest ideas about fluid dynamics of meteorite impacts and volcanic eruptions. So we'd sit around campfires at Mule Ear or Moses Rock diatremes in Utah or around Meteor Crater in Arizona, and we'd talk about the similarities and differences in the fluid dynamics of meteorite impacts and volcanic eruptions. Remember that all of this was in the context of the 1960s, when there was a great controversy about whether the craters on the moon were due to meteorite impact or volcanic eruptions. At that time, I felt I had little hope of ever studying volcanoes professionally, because my only geology education had been auditing Geology 1 at Caltech. My early career opportunities after my PhD had had nothing to do with either meteorite impacts or volcanic eruptions or anything that I'd studied in my PhD years. However, in 1976, when I was a baby professor at UCLA, I saw this photograph of Old Faithful Geyser taken by a very famous U.S. photographer, Ansel Adams. As an artist, Ansel Adams' eye had clearly been caught by the beautiful surges in the eruption plume. As the musician that I was actually raised to be, my eyes and imagination were caught by these same surges. And I said, aha, I'll bet that conduit is acting like an organ pipe, and the surges reflected by the lights and darks in the photo are telling me about the resonances of that conduit. And I also realized in that same instant that I saw this photograph that I could study volcanoes and volcanic processes without knowing a thing about rocks. I could first study geysers, and then I could apply the results of my research to volcanoes, learning about rocks along the way. At the time I had developed my organ pipe theory for Old Faithful, I had absolutely no publication record in geyser or volcanic dynamics. But such is the nature of curiosity in youth that I took a summer off to go to Yellowstone with my 9-year-old kid as a field assistant and the family bank account as my research support. Based on that summer, I laid out a rather optimistic 5-year plan to study geyser and volcano eruptions, and I submitted it to the National Science Foundation. They funded it as a high-risk possibility. Many people ask me why I work on Old Faithful rather than on the many other geysers in Yellowstone in the world. And there are actually fluid dynamic reasons that this geyser is unique. One of them is my own hypothesis that this geyser is Mach 1 at the vent. But there are also philosophic challenges in how one approaches science. And working on Old Faithful symbolizes to me some of these challenges. In geologic problems, we have to use every bit of ingenuity and technology available to study phenomena that are fundamentally inaccessible and often very hostile. We can't control geologic processes at any significant scale, and we don't have the privilege of designating what data we would prefer to have. We take whatever we can get. We are, and always will be, fundamentally different than a laboratory science in this respect. I face these same limitations in studying Old Faithful because it's a sacred, protected, and fragile feature. My self-imposed job was to try to figure out how this geyser worked without invading its sanctity. Well, I use my eyes a lot because I really like to study things that move, and I like to study things that move really fast. So my project started with techniques that I thought were really high-tech in the 1970s. I took a bunch of students, undergraduate students, to Yellowstone, and we filmed the geysers with Super 8 movie cameras. I could measure the plume height through the eruptions and begin to get some data on the velocity that the water and the steam erupted from the vent. However, this was very frustrating because the water in Old Faithful is about 5 meters below the surface when an eruption begins, and so I was only seeing part of the plume and part of the process that was triggering the eruptions. And as I was working on this speech today, I suddenly realized that a very frustrating facet of my life has been that there's these mysterious things below ground just out of the reach of my arms, like that ditch and now this geyser. So I keep getting drawn into these problems in research. Well, I decided that the only way I could get an indication of what was going on underground in the conduit was to learn seismology. So I took a couple of seismometers to Yellowstone. Well, I'd never done seismology, but with a technician and a textbook, I went to Yellowstone in March, when there are very few tourists in the park, and I began my seismic work. I spent one of the coldest weeks in my life trying to instrument Old Faithful. In this slide, which is a little plastic bag, my tech Gonzalo and I are hunkered down in our plastic greenhouse trying to scare the poltergeists out of our instruments. And that was the expression we used for trying to get these bulky instruments to work in the cold. I ended this miserable week by running across some snow-covered black ice and breaking my leg. Well, the work paid off. This slide shows the seismic signals of Old Faithful on the bottom And a record of signals from Karkar volcano in New Guinea, which erupted and killed several volcanologists. And I actually have to look and constantly refresh myself. I know that the Old Faithful record has the diagonal lines. Because of the similarity that we discovered between Old Faithful and volcanic eruptions, seismologists now realize that they need to seriously consider the role of water as well as rock in the eruption dynamics of volcanoes. Well, I decided that if we could systematically sample water during the eruptions of Old Faithful to analyze for chemical variations, we might get some extra information about temperatures at depth. This turns out to be one of the most fun as well and photogenic experiments I've ever done, as well as one of the most futile. And I have a series of about 10 slides to show you this. I'm on the left, and my friend, the park geologist at Yellowstone, Rick Hutchinson, is on the right. And you see, we have a really nice experiment set up where Rick's going to stick this little prod into Old Faithful and catch some water in a little plastic bucket. And I'm holding a bottle, and he's going to put that water in my bottle, and I'm going to cap it, and then he's going to run back and get some more water. We have these yellow and green buckets, and there's some bottles somewhere in that picture. And then this is the seismometer in the garbage bag that we're going to try not to step on during this. So here goes Rick sampling the water. Now, I learned later that this water is coming out of here at something like 250 kilometers an hour. And so but I didn't know it at the time. I was really optimistic. So Rick's going to grab some water and pour it in the bucket or the bottle. And then he's going to go back and try to catch some more water. But you see, our buckets have kind of gotten out of control because it turns out Old Faithful has a mind of its own. And, whoops, well, we're going forward as well as reverse here. But this basically turned into chaos with buckets and bottles trying to catch this water. And I think you might be getting an idea that we actually didn't get any real systematic science out of this, but we had an awful lot of fun. I will confess that this is probably the only experiment in my life that I'll concede that a man can do that a woman can't. It turns out there's really hot steam there, and if you have a beard, you can avoid getting scalded on your face. And since I can't grow a beard, I actually cannot go into that plume without getting seriously injured. So this is Rick just kind of getting our samples. And then we have a little exercise of trying to dry his boots out. You can see this. So it's okay to show that science is actually fun sometimes, even when you don't get good results. Well, my five-year plan to complete my studies on geysers and volcanoes was barely into its third year when it received the first of several major setbacks. The volcanoes of the solar system didn't care a bit about my five-year plan, and they were to provide me with the first real opportunity of my career. In 1979, the Voyager spacecraft flew by Io, which is a satellite of Jupiter. Photographs such as these showed plumes soaring almost as high as 400 kilometers. One of the instruments on board the spacecraft measured sulfur dioxide in one of the plumes, and the Voyager imaging team proposed that the plumes were due to volcanic eruptions of sulfur and sulfur dioxide. The sulfurous chemistry accounted for the red, yellow, black, and white colors that made Io looked like a pizza. I was at the U.S. Geological Survey in Flagstaff, Arizona at the time, and my colleagues who were on the spacecraft team called me and asked me to try to work out a thermodynamic theory for the eruptions based on my work on the thermodynamics of Old Faithful. My gut feeling was, oh no, it's too soon. I'm only 3 years into my five-year plans and I haven't even started on volcanoes on the Earth. Well, here I was being asked to extrapolate my ideas about Old Faithful to the crazy world of Io, where gravity is about a sixth that of the Earth, where the surface temperatures are relatively cold, 130 Kelvin, and where the atmospheric pressure is 10 orders of magnitude less than that on the Earth, and where the chemistry is unlike anything we've ever encountered on the Earth. Well, to a physical chemist, the fact that geysers happen to be erupting sulfur and sulfur dioxide instead of water is just a matter of thermodynamic scaling. And to a physicist, the fact that they are erupting in a lower gravitational field than on the Earth is just a matter of physical scaling. And to an engineer, the fact that they're erupting into a near vacuum instead of a heavy atmosphere is just a matter of rocket nozzle theory. Using theories from all of these disciplines, I calculated that Old Faithful, which erupts to a height of about 100 or 150 feet on the Earth in Yellowstone, would form a plume about 20 miles high on Io. Old Faithful would, in fact, have been called a volcano if discovered by Voyager. And in fact, the Ionian volcanoes and the work that we did caused a redefinition of the words volcano and geyser in a planetary context. For my whole professional life, I've been in institutions where the Earth is viewed as a member of a family of planets rather than a unique, isolated body. Only 1 year after this apparently esoteric exercise in trying to extrapolate Old Faithful to Ionian conditions, I was going to be faced with a problem back on Earth for which the planetary exercise had me ready to look at our own planet and its volcanoes in a different way. The reason that we geologists need to study other planets is that the Earth is really only a single data set, and we scientists always learn something if we can look at more than one data set. Many of you have probably heard of dangerous volcanic eruptions being like the explosion of a pressure cooker or a boiler. My work on planetary volcanism and geysers has really boiled down, if I could use a pun, to trying to figure out how a common kitchen pressure cooker would explode on planets that have very different atmosphere, from Venus, which has an atmospheric pressure about 100 times of that of the Earth, to Io, which has a pressure about 10 orders of magnitude less. And it turns out that if the pressure cooker pressure is more than about 10 times atmospheric pressure, you can't address the problem without understanding supersonic flow. Well, as I was saying, in 1979, I was 3 years into my 5-year plan to study geysers. I was just finishing up the Io geyser problem in early 1980 and getting back to thinking about Old Faithful from this new planetary perspective when Mount St. Helens began acting up in March of 1980. My 5-year plan was clearly in trouble again. Volcanoes were erupting not only over the whole solar system, but in my own backyard on Earth. Within an hour of hearing of the eruption of Mount St. Helens, I packed to catch an airplane out of Flagstaff. I wasn't even sure what state Mount St. Helens was in. And if the truth be known, quite a number of the people who worked very hard in those early days had the same problems. We as individuals and the U.S. Geological Survey as an organization were improvising in response to this emergency. My appearance at Mount St. Helens carrying a Super 8 movie camera claiming that it was my major research tool didn't get me very close to the mountain. But we rented a car and we navigated through a snowstorm to a place where we thought we might see the volcano. We pitched our tent after calculating the orientation of the tent flap that would allow a view of Mount St. Helens from our sleeping bags, so that we might see the mountain if the storm ever ended. We went to sleep with my Super 8 and 35 millimeter cameras and film tucked into the sleeping bags. And parenthetically, I can clean up a loose end of my talk here. I faintly made use of that home ec course in junior high school because the tent, as well as some of our winter clothes that we took to Mount St. Helens, were homemade specials done on a 1923 Singer sewing machine while we were grad students and too poor to buy a real tent or raincoats or down booties. And I still say I'd rather have taken shop. Well, we were awakened the next morning by thunder. And this was very mysterious because we could see through the tent that the sun was out. We opened the tent flap and had our first view of Mount St. Helens. Any scientist who has had the fortune of being in exactly the right place at the right time in their research scheme of things cannot help but feel that thrill of victory. In this case, there was a lot of yelling and screaming and thanking the volcano gods and general chaos as we tried to get the tripods and cameras out of the tent to do some serious filming while not missing the lightning flashes that were causing the thunder in this column of dust and ash. There was little of the perceived sterile scientific method in that first morning. It was a joyous and fulfilling experience to see a volcano erupting. Well, to one who sees geysers everywhere in the solar system, the eruptions like this in March and April were little more than big geyser eruptions. And this is a series that was taken from an airplane by Austin Post that shows a little typical March and April eruption. It's actually not that much bigger than our Old Faithful eruption. And this took place over a period of about 6 minutes. I felt I knew what was happening during these geyser eruptions, but what we didn't know was what this March-April sequence was telling us about the larger scale changes in the budget of heat and water inside the mountain. I needed more observations and volunteered to go live in a tent that the U.S. Geological Survey and the Forest Service had set up nearby. Without time to get supplies or water, I was taken by snowmobile into this tent and told that I'd enjoy K rations and could melt snow for water. A snowmobile would be back the next day with real food and water. Well, the thrill of victory of my one side of the erupting volcano quickly turned into the agony of defeat. This is the best series of slides I got, and I point out that you can see the top of the plume here. You can see the bottom of the plume here. You can see the middle of the plume. No, you can see the top and the bottom there. And you can see the middle there. These were not scientifically useful observations. I spent 4 days in this tent, and it was cold, miserable, lonely, wet, and boring. I was unable to get any significant observations, and I began to wonder if I actually cared about research at all. After all, we researchers are only humans, and we don't like to get cold and hungry, especially if it's boring. Well, one afternoon, I noticed that the snow falling in my tent had a healthy concentration of ash in it, which indicated that the volcano was erupting somewhere out in the fog. I decided that my contribution to advancing either my own knowledge or that of humanity was definitely not very significant, and I was also sick of K rations, since the promised food and water had never arrived. So I radioed headquarters and asked them to send back the snowmobile. I radioed again every hour for 4 hours. And finally, headquarters confessed that they had forgotten where they put me. Well, the science and hazards work that were done at Mount St. Helens represented a marvelous convergence of government, political, and scientific groups. But getting me out of that tent was not one of its better efforts. Fortunately, I had a pair of snowshoes, and I learned to snowshoe by packing up and snowshoeing out to find a highway where I hitchhiked back to headquarters. Well, these were complex times scientifically and logistically. We had scientists from all sorts of disciplines trying to figure out what the volcano was doing. Three counties had jurisdiction over the roads, and my experience in slipping in and out of the dorms after hours at college to do physics labs came in handy in trying to get past sheriffs and roadblocks. Numerous federal agencies and universities, the state of Washington, and the president of the U.S. were to be involved. And it's really easy to stand here on a night like this and tell you that a life of research is fun, and most of us would choose no other life. But it carries enormous responsibilities, and you won't see many smiles on the faces of volcanologists trying to deal with a restless volcano. The early eruptions had quieted down, and yet instrumentation that had been set in place showed that the north side of the mountain was bulging out at the rate of several meters per day. A substantial portion of the land around the mountain was declared a hazard zone, and against many political, economic, and economic pressures that came from shutting down prime logging country, a large area was closed to public access. May 18th came and went. This was the last night at my tent. And the history of volcanology was changed. This is a series of slides that were taken by Keith Ronholm of the lateral blast. You can see the ridges, in front of this cloud advancing. He was about 20 kilometers from the volcano, maybe 25 kilometers. The eruption on Sunday morning, that Sunday morning, clearly was not a geyser eruption. And we didn't know what happened, but it clearly wasn't good. This is the tent site that I had abandoned only 6 weeks earlier. It had been buried in meters of ash. And that's the car of a National Geographic photographer who had been in there. The lumbering equipment from Weyerhaeuser revealed the destructive power of the event that came to be known as the lateral blast. The trees told an incredible story of battering and pummeling by rock-like shrapnel, and they vividly illustrated the destructive powers of the ash hurricane that had sped across the land at more than 350 kilometers per hour. The layout of the trees on the ground seemed to me to hold the key to the mystery of what had happened inside the lateral blast cloud. Using techniques that I had learned for mapping rocks and geologic formations onto maps, I spent months in my office with air photos, maps, and the details of the tree patterns. This is a detail of part of my map. As I've said, most of a researcher's life is discipline and day-to-day routine. Spending months looking at photographs of a billion board feet of downed timber covered with gray ash takes patience and discipline. But after a year of mapping tree blowdown patterns and thinking of Io volcano dynamics, I crystallized an explanation that I thought explained most of what I was seeing. This slide shows you my generalized map of the tree blowdown area, and I need you to remember three things about it. First, that the devastation's all on the north side of the volcano. It's north of the little X. And secondly, that there's an inner red zone, which is the zone that was totally devastated. There were essentially not even any tree stumps or soil left. And thirdly, that there's a fairly sharp boundary between the red and the yellow zone. Now remember that I had told you that volcanic eruptions can be compared to pressure cooker explosions. Well, that's actually not a good description, because the word explosion brings to mind nuclear and chemical bombs, with the connotation of very high pressures and instantaneous energy release. And there's no evidence that extraordinarily high pressures comparable to bomb pressures exist inside volcanoes. I began working on a theory that the discharge of volcanic gases through the side of the mountain was more like the discharge of steam through a small hole in the side of a pressure cooker rather than the explosion of a whole pot. More accurately, I began comparing the lateral blast through the side of Mount St. Helens to the discharge of high-pressure gas through a rocket nozzle. Research ideas in their infancy are tentative and fragile, and it doesn't take much data from the field or skepticism by colleagues to destroy one. I was so unsure of where this type of thinking would lead that I did all of the calculations tediously by hand, because it wasn't worth writing a computer program for the theory that was likely to be so wrong. So I just put in some slides of my really early theories so that you don't get the impression that all science is nicely drafted, like you see on slides. But as I worked my way through these calculations day by day, I was getting a gut feeling that in spite of all the limitations and simplifying approximations, I was beginning to know what happened inside the mountain. The pattern of downed trees that I mapped seemed to me to be consistent with a flow pattern that I was calculating. This is a bit fancier slide of the theory, and it shows how a supersonic flow field can be divided into two major parts. This is a view that a fluid dynamicist in an airplane looking down inside the lateral blast would see. The vent of the volcano is at the bottom, and it's modeled like a rocket nozzle. Close to the nozzle or to the mountain, there's a very high supersonic core area that's about 100 square kilometers when scaled to Mount St. Helens, and that's the area shown in pink on this slide. Inside this core, velocities got as high, according to my model, as 700 kilometers per hour, certainly sufficient to strip a forest and a soil, and the soil's everywhere. And this inner supersonic zone in pink is bounded by a strong standing shock wave called a Mach disk shock in aeronautics. And the rocket nozzle scaling relations that I was using suggested that this shock would have stood about 10 kilometers north of the mountain, approximately at the distance where my tent had been placed only a few months earlier. Well, this theory is very simplified, but a few pieces of a large puzzle were falling into place. The observations were making sense. When I compared my model with the map of the tree blowdown, which I've done here by just overlaying the theory on the map, things like the shape of the devastated area and the difference between the red and brown tree blowdown zones could be explained. The map difference in the tree blowdown patterns coincided approximately with my calculated position of the Mach disk shock. Well, during the year that I worked on this theory, I was convinced that I had a new direction to go, and it wasn't anywhere in my original 5-year plan for studying geysers. I had to seriously enter the world of supersonic flow. a mathematically difficult and non-intuitive world, and one which requires the largest supercomputers for solutions to the equations. The simplest model that has any physics in it, preserved at all, requires the solution of 16 simultaneous equations. And my students really loved it when I told them I was going to go to a meeting and show 16 simultaneous equations. And they were really relieved when I showed them this slide. Fortunately, in this past decade, we've seen an explosion of computational power. And the next step in understanding what happened at Mount St. Helens and in trying to improve our understanding of volcanic hazards can only be taken by becoming part of a revolution that's taken part in computing technology. Working with colleagues at Los Alamos National Lab in New Mexico, we solved these equations using a Big Cray computer. We could actually do it on a Sun workstation now. And we created a video animation of the solutions, which I'd like to just show you about 30 seconds of. Turn the slides off. Okay, we can't do the lateral blast yet with only 16 equations. We're going to need some humongous more. But this is an animation that we did of a big caldera eruption like formed the Valles caldera around New Mexico. So you're seeing a volcanic eruption out of a central vent, and we've placed an annular rim around the volcano at a distance of about 3 kilometers. And you're seeing an animation of what you would see if you were an observer that could look through the cloud. If you were standing outside it in the real world, you'd only see about into the gray, and you wouldn't see any of the really interesting and potentially lethally flows that were going out in the red. This goes on, and we show pressure and temperature. But basically, the only point I want to make is that we can now do things based on supercomputer technology, both in teaching and research, that we couldn't do a decade ago. My colleague in this work, Greg Valentine, is coming up to UBC next summer to continue this work and to hopefully get us into the lateral blast and to explore new directions that we can go with the supercomputing. Well, I've tried to show here the fundamental nature of research. As we get deeper and deeper into mysteries, we find more and more things that we didn't know, and we need to keep on going. Let's see. But to keep on going, we as individual researchers, we had to change slide trays here. We as individual researchers need to re-examine our own motives, and our institutions and supporting agencies and taxpaying citizens need to know what the benefit of that work is going to be. So I want to address the issue of application of our work. Now I know I have all the right things here. Let's see, try. Where's the red phone? Okay. Mickey, I need that second slide, Trey. There we go. Okay, we've got it. Okay, let me give a specific example of the application of the volcanic work and then generalize to the role of science and technology in society. The events of 1980 at Mount St. Helens have caused geologists to re-examine the history of other volcanic eruptions. We no longer think that the events at Mount St. Helens were unique. There was probably at least one lateral blast at Mount St. Helens before the one in 1980, but we couldn't see it or look for it because there had never been a well-documented example of this kind of process. Now, a decade later, lateral blasts have been proposed at least a dozen other volcanoes around the world. Some of the volcanoes that are remarkably similar to Mount St. Helens have millions of people living on their flanks. And a direct application of our geologic mapping and theory is the development of volcanic hazards plans based on models of the processes that occur during these eruptions and our best estimate of possible precursors of these eruptions. Well, individual contributions, such as my own theoretical interpretation of the lateral blast, may advance only one small part of a very complex problem. My friend Tom, who was studying kimberlites and diatremes with me at Caltech, has since died. But his last thoughts to his colleagues were about the feeling of satisfaction that he had at adding one small stone to the collection that constitutes the foundation of human knowledge. Collectively, we as geologists work to make a solid foundation of knowledge from our own small building blocks and to use that foundation to allow these volcanoes to be safer places for humans to live and visit. I'd like to go beyond my own personal science or that of my geology and planetary colleagues to speak about the responsibilities that we researchers have to society. Nearly half the bills that come before the U.S. Congress have a significant scientific and technologic component, and many issues that voters face at the local, state, and national levels have a similar content. Our work is needed, as is its application and communication. Sometimes the application of our work is obvious and immediate, in volcanic, seismic, or engineering geology applications, for example. In other instances, the application is less obvious, and it may not occur until well into the future. If we are to have public support for our work in the future, we must take seriously the responsibility for recognizing the potential for our discoveries, for maintaining the highest standards possible in our work and in our community, and for being concerned and involved with the broader uses of science and technology. To do our work, we not only need the public support and belief in our work, but we also need strong and streamlined administrative report. And I'd like to illustrate this by telling you how I suddenly ended up applying my supersonic volcanic theory to Colorado River hydraulics. And this anecdote also illustrates the intertwined nature of teaching and research. I had been asked to go over to Caltech as a visiting professor in 1982 to teach geological fluid dynamics. I found it extremely difficult to teach supersonic rocket nozzle theory to geologists because of this fact that our intuition about processes is based entirely on living in a subsonic world. And most of the processes in the supersonic world are actually counterintuitive. For example, this is a supersonic plume in a geothermal well in the Philippines. And if you were to calculate any physical properties down the axis of this supersonic plume, they would have the opposite sign of the properties in a subsonic plume. The only textbooks about this were and still are in aeronautics. And you can only go so far teaching geologists about airplane wings before they legitimately ask for an explanation of how this is ever going to be relevant to their lives. Well, while struggling with this problem teaching, I had discovered that I could use a rather old analogy between shock waves and gases and standing waves on water as a teaching tool. And you can teach yourselves a lot about this analogy by putting a flat plate under your kitchen sink faucet and playing with the circular wave that develops and moves around as you change the faucet settings. The standing wave divides the water on the plate into two flow regimes. An inner circle where the water is shallow and is flowing out very fast toward the edge, and an outer zone where the water is deeper and moves slower. A circular standing wave separates these two zones, and the water depth and velocity change discontinuously across the wave. It's called a hydraulic jump, and it's circular in this context because of the cylindrical symmetry of the jet from the faucet, but it doesn't have to be circular. And once you get your eye trained, you can see these waves all over, like in rain gutters and especially in rivers. Well, the teaching analogy is this. In gases, we talk about supersonic and subsonic flow, described by high and low Mach numbers. And they're separated, these two flow regimes are separated by Mach number, by shock waves. In water flowing in channels, like rivers, we talk about subcritical and supercritical flow, described by low and high Froude numbers and separated by hydraulic jumps. And this was the link that allowed me to divert to river studies. In the summer of 1983, there was a big flood on the Colorado River in the Grand Canyon. A stationary wave that was more than 15 feet high stood across the river in one of the rapids, Crystal Rapids. Several people were killed by boating accidents in this wave, and hundreds were stranded in the Grand Canyon. That boat with pontoons is 12 feet wide. No one knew where this wave came from or what caused it, though the common explanation was that there was a boulder in the river. I was walking home from work one night through a meadow thinking about this when I had one of those wonderful flashes that scientists love. I still remember that footstep that I was taking when I thought, aha, that's no rock. That's the hydraulic equivalent of my mock disk shock at Mount St. Helens. I was in the U.S. Geological Survey at the time, and I had a branch chief who was very supportive and never wasted words. Here I was, a theoretical volcanologist, trying my best to get focus back on geysers in the aftermath of Mount St. Helens, calling him and saying that I was about to take off in a helicopter to go look at a water wave. I told him I'd explain later if he really wanted to hear it, and his answer was music to a researcher's ears. Sue, go for it. My job is to make sure that you can do your job. Well, my hunch proved right, and I spent 5 years working on measurements of hydraulics in the rapids of the Colorado River. And during this time, I worked with the National Park Service on the implications of my hydraulic theories for hazards to recreational rafting, and with the Bureau of Reclamation on implications for the sediment transport problems of the river and schemes to optimize the operation of Glen Canyon Dam. And most exciting to me was I developed a new theory about the relation of the river and the rapids to the classic problem of the downcutting of the Grand Canyon. One of the most satisfying intellectual rewards to a geologist has to be the changing perception of your own personal world as you gain intellectual understanding of the processes that carved your landscape and influenced your lives. Well, believe it or not, I actually had gotten started back on my Old Faithful work in 1988, after a 5-year hiatus to study the Colorado. With a colleague, Jim Westfall from Caltech, I'd put a probe down into Old Faithful way back in 1983 and 84, and I was eager to analyze the data because I was beginning to forget the complex calibration procedures that we had used. We had measured pressure and temperature in the conduit, not only between eruptions, but actually through a couple of eruptions, and this was going to be exciting data. And one day, while I was deep into this project, in 1989, I got another phone call from JPL. Voyager spacecraft was out near Neptune and taking photos of the icy satellite Triton. This planet's cold. We don't think it's big enough to generate volcanic types of heat, and it's so deep in the solar system that it hardly receives any sunlight. The surface temperature is only 38 Kelvin. The Voyager scientists had discovered plumes rising to 8 kilometers height. Now, this slide's actually in focus. That's the quality of the Voyager data, but you can see a plume sticking up out of the middle there. And I groaned because I saw a really scary problem coming. Sure enough, these friends and colleagues wanted me to do some calculations to tell them if nitrogen or methane geysers could be erupting and causing the plumes. We came up with a theory that the small bit of heat from the sun that reaches Triton could cause pockets of nitrogen gas to form within the ice cap. This nitrogen gas might only be 42 Kelvin, in contrast to the 38 Kelvin of the ice, but I calculated that that was enough thermal energy to get the plumes 8 kilometers above the surface. Well, during all of these distractions to my Old Faithful work, I'd gotten very frustrated that my understanding of it was limited by my lack of knowledge of the geometry of the conduit. So 2 years ago, I was back on Old Faithful again, and Jim Westfall had won a MacArthur Fellowship and decided that he'd like to spend some of his prize money to solve our problem of determining the shape of the conduit. Remember that I had attacked this problem way back in the mid-70s with my seismic work, but because of technology changes, we no longer have to rely on seismic inferences. Jim designed and built an elegant, small, ice-insulated video camera to insert into the geyser, and I'd like to show you a bit of the footage that we obtained in 1992. This has a soundtrack with it, and I need to tell you that we had just gone down into the conduit 40 feet and come out.
On, see a little more details about that.
Okay, could we have the volume louder?
So we decide, in fact, to go back down again. We have an awful lot of nice video there, and if somehow we do the camera in this process, well, we tried. And we have a lot of information that will keep us busy for quite some time. So now that we kind of know what to expect, we'll see and recognize things better than we did the first time down. Notice how very smooth the walls are. That's the center coating everything. There's our waterfall again, really quite striking in the right-hand side of the picture. But really, there's not very much water in that. And you can see there are little puddles of water all over that shine in the lights. And now we can already see the top of the boiling water. It's coming very much higher up into the vent than it was when we were down just a few minutes ago. We've come to our little shelf again, and the first of the little shelves, and we bang around on it again, and we manage to get by it. Notice, though, that there's lots of water boiling around. It's turning the camera around. There's our shelf where we got stuck last time, and we have to worry about whether we're going to get stuck again. And sure enough, we do. The camera is now not moving. But then suddenly something happens, probably a big splash of water from the wild boiling, and kind of knocks us off of the shelf. And now we've gone down a little ways, and we really are seeing the wildly boiling water and water pouring around us in all directions. And looks like a tornado now and again as it twists the camera, spins the camera around on the end of its cable. We really became very concerned whether our camera could survive all of this. It certainly wasn't made with that in mind.
Okay, well, you can see more of this if you go to IMAX next summer, because they've just, they're going to use some of this in a new IMAX production for West Yellowstone. Well, let me conclude by reminding you that I've taken a lot of liberty to tell you about supersonic flow in geology through the use of a lot of personal anecdotes. And I did this because of a license granted, which is really a mandate given by the National Academy of Sciences report on being a scientist. And I'd like to close by repeating the part of the mandate that I believe is perhaps the most elegant statement that I've seen about life as a researcher. It speaks better than I can about the marvelous life that I feel researching the Earth. Scientists should explain and defend the scientific worldview, a prospect of great beauty and grandeur that ought to be a part of how people think about themselves and their place in nature. Scientific research is an intensely human endeavor. This humanity must not be lost in the face that science presents to the world. So thank you very much.
You want to take questions?
Sure. You want the microphone? I'm sorry. Yes.
Could you please tell us something about the direction of the vent in Thompson Helens? Was it on an angle, or was it vertically outward?
Okay, the question is, could I tell something about the direction of the vent in Mount St. Helens? The actual triggering of the vent was very complicated. The north side of the mountain bulged out, and there was a series of three landslides. A smaller first one, a big second one, and a smaller later third one. These took place over probably close to a minute. And the eruption actually was a complicated process of steam bursting out from all three of these, but mostly from the second one. And there's quite a bit of question about how vertical it was or how horizontal. Some of the seismic data is actually interpreted as having a vertical thrust. But the photography from all angles is of very high velocities, up to 100 kilometers a second, 100 meters a second, sorry, coming out laterally. So that's one of those things we don't know. It was totally obscured by the cloud. And so the best reconstruction from all the different photos and videos has put together this sequence of three landslides. So the vent was probably a huge scar, like the scar of a landslide face. with the help of a pulley. Yes, it's little boys like to roll rocks down slope. Yes.
I was a little fascinated by the TV sequence that showed a tube rising and then falling and spreading. It's very similar to what happens if you drop a marble into a bowl of milk, for example, to get a little tube.
Okay, yes. The question is that there's a similarity between the computer simulation of the volcanic eruption where the flow rose up high and then fell back, and the experiment of dropping a marble in a bowl of milk where you get a jet of milk that comes up and then falls back. Let me say, it's probably no accident that people who study volcanoes also study things like meteorite impacts or drops of water that make craters. And a lot of the similarity is because you get a trade-off between potential energy and kinetic energy. Things rise up until they run out of velocity. They stop, and then they fall back if they're heavy enough. The difference between the bowl of milk and the volcanic eruption is that the bowl of milk experiment is an incompressible fluid, and so everything in it, that would be subsonic if you performed the experiment at low velocities. And the volcanic problem is at high velocities with gases. But you see similar waves because of this hydraulic analogy to the gases. During World War II, bowls of milk or flumes were actually called the poor man's wind tunnel. And they actually designed rocket nozzles using flumes when there was too expensive to build wind tunnels. So there are a lot of similarities in the processes. If I was to name the planets, how many are there? Oh my. I think I'm about to fail Astronomy 1. With planets and satellites, maybe close to 20. And there's such a gradation in size that it's hard to keep track of where to stop counting them. I think of 20 major bodies, basically. I just keep hoping there's no more geysers and volcanoes. I just was getting so, every 3 or 4 years, I dreaded picking up the telephone. It's a pretty exciting time to be a planetary scientist. Why did I buy where I was? That's really a fun question. Okay, the question was, which side of a hydraulic jump would you prefer being on? If I can plead a little bit of ignorance about details of the Squamish winds, I've been alerted to them and by my dean. If I could go back to the Colorado River hydraulic jump, where I actually have some numbers, that boat was going into that. You go into that wave at very high velocities, and there's an instantaneous deceleration at the wave, and you come out of it at low velocities. And the deceleration through that jump on the Colorado River was about 25 or 30 miles an hour. And that's why this 60 horsepower motor of that boat was ineffective because it just couldn't provide the boat with enough thrust to control anything. So in terms of just straight wind velocity, you'd rather be on the downstream side of the hydraulic jump where things are quieter. But that's also where all the flying tree trunks and everything finally settles out. So I think you have to pick and choose your fate on those. I think living in Horseshoe Bay is pretty exciting. And I haven't even been in one of the real winds, but I can tell you my roof wasn't designed for those. There's really interesting things, like where is gold deposit in rivers relative to those jumps? Where are the boulders? And how do you interpret features on the downstream side of those? So that's, I hadn't thought of it as real estate. Certainly didn't ask the question before I bought my house. No, the moral of the story is you keep rewriting five-year plans and hoping you have very wise funding agencies. I actually still do not understand Old Faithful. I finally published that I think it's Mach 1 at the vent. It's just weakly supersonic, and it's probably subsonic again on the part you see. We are still working on our pressure and temperature data. My colleague Jim is actually the PI on the Wide Field Camera on Space Telescope. So he's now in a phase of his career where, you know, they're launching shuttle next week to replace the lens in the space telescope. So he's off doing that. And between the two of us, we've spent 10 years not overlapping on getting our data done. But we redesigned the camera and went back to Yellowstone last year, and we actually designed a worse camera. We went underwater last year, and we could see the bubbles. But we didn't get footage that was as good as that. So we're planning on going back next fall and doing it right. I'm trying to tie my Old Faithful work into epithermal vein deposits and mineral deposits in the context of my work here in BC. So it's just a five-year plan that's going to carry me right through my life, I guess. So, yes? Okay, well, that's a broad question. I'm running out. The question is, how do I reconcile, setbacks, family life? It's juggling a lot. There's, I told the upbeat side of the story, and I think it's been a pretty incredible life. It is stressful in the family sense, but I, in fact, had some really wonderful years. I took my kid to Yellowstone, got him out of Los Angeles. We lived in a little 12-foot trailer. A line that I heard not too long ago, it was actually said that Caltech graduates are probably some of the best people in the world at making lemonade out of lemons. And some of these opportunities were actually forced on me by circumstances of job improvision. And I think an awful lot of what you do with an event is make it an opportunity or a setback. And so it's hard to say anything really specific about it other than it's not always as kind of fun as you summarize in 1 hour looking back over 30 years of a career. It's doable, and I think that one of the really important things about having women and couples in science now is that there can be a lot of different options looked at. I had a kid and a family and combined all those things. And it's pretty tiring. You have to have a lot of energy and a pretty understanding family structure. Which I do. everybody. Okay, the question was, what's the current status of the capability for predicting river floods? And I really have to duck on that. I'm not at all into the larger scale monitoring of hydrology. I was dealing with, actually, when I started my river hydraulics work, I had to learn that hydraulics was different than hydrology. And I was really just studying the channel flow. The runoff in the years I was working in the 80s with the Colorado River Project, it was still pretty much a crapshoot. The Bureau of Rec said that they would never, ever have to spill water through Glen Canyon Dam after 1983 again, because they almost lost the bypass tubes. There was a huge erosion process, and the next 4 years they had to spill water. And the problem there was managing the reservoir filled and balancing it against the runoff in the Rockies. I think that's improving all the time because of satellite techniques, but I'm not in that line of work at all. I can say our volcanic hazards prediction has gotten somewhat better, but that's more my field. I think I'm losing my voice.
Thank you, Professor Kiefer. I'd like to call on Dean Barry McBride to thank Professor Kiefer on our behalf.
Is this on? Can you hear me? Well, it's a pleasure to be here and to be able to thank Sue on our behalf. I hadn't realized I was going to have this privilege until just a few minutes before Sue started to talk, but it really is a pleasure. I think a number of us must have been reflecting back on where we were on the day that Mount St. Helens went off, surrounded as we are by volcanoes, with Mount St. Helens so close. It certainly brought back memories to me. I was camped with my family beside a small, well, what was a small creek when we put the tent up the hills towards Pemberton, up in the Joffrey Creek area. And I now realize that what was concerning me were these hydraulic jumps that were getting ominously large as the snow melted in this hot, sunny day. And I'd say the best place to be on a hydraulic jump is beside it, not in front of it or behind it.
That's why he's a dean and I'm a professor.
We move quickly. I think there's a popular misconception out there about research universities and research professors. And the misconception goes that people who are really interested and deeply involved in their science don't care about teaching, don't get involved in their teaching, and aren't very good teachers. And I think we've had a very good lesson tonight that certainly isn't the case. We've listened to an absolutely outstanding research scientist who's made many and very important observations, and also, obviously, someone who cares very deeply about teaching and about getting the message across. I think we're very fortunate to have Sue here. And I want you to join me in thanking her for this, I think, very personal journey, which led her into science and the kinds of rewards that she has received and the kinds of contributions she's been able to make. So, Sue, thank you very much.